You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And what have we got coming up on the show for you today? Well, it's a good one today, as it always is. Our studio guest is Sarah Shaw, author of Portland Place, a memoir of life as a BBC secretary and young woman growing up in the early 1970s. We'll also be hearing from Jane Mensah about her spy novel, An Unlikely Agent, and Emma Bennett, editor of the Cambridge Art Book, will be telling us all about that. So, hello, Sarah.
Hello.
Thank you for coming to Bookmark. We're going to give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we've got Emma Bennett coming up talking about the Cambridge Art Book. You're not a Cambridge girl, are you? Not an accusation, that. Just a fact.
No, I originate from South London. But moved up to a village just outside Cambridge back in the late 1970s, very late 1970s, and also worked in Cambridge eventually for about 20 years in public libraries and ultimately university libraries too. And my last job was as the librarian at Selwyn College, which was an absolutely fantastic place to work.
Oh, that does sound lovely. And we're talking about working at the BBC in the early 1970s. Mm-hmm. When you almost had to have a degree from Oxbridge then, didn't you?
Well, to get on, you did. But, of course, there were a lot of posts for clerical and secretarial staff in those days. And most of those were staffed by people from grammar school backgrounds who hadn't got to university. So it was kind of like the level down, if you like, from the very bright people. But, yes, beyond that, if you wanted to get into production or any of the really interesting jobs, yes, you did have to have a degree, and an Oxbridge one was even better.
Well, we're going to be talking a lot about the BBC in just a moment, but we'll listen to your first choice of music, which is Elton John and your song. Why this one?
Interesting. It came out around the time that I began a relationship, which is described in the book, and I think it just evokes so well that lovely light feeling you get when you fall in love with somebody for the first time in your life.
I'm not one of those who can easily hide. I don't have much money, but boy, if I did, I'd buy a big house where we both could live. If I was a sculptor, but then again, no.
That's Elton John and your song, a first choice of music from our studio guest today on Bookmark, Sarah Shaw. Sarah, you were enjoying that, weren't you?
Yes, I was. And there's an extraordinary little story about it, because when I was editing my book, when I got to the end of it and I'd finished with it and I shut it down on the computer and I switched on my music on shuffle, it was the first one that came up. I thought, oh, that's funny. And then I realised there was this line about it, I hope you don't mind that I put down in words. And I thought, oh my goodness, that's exactly what I've just done. It was quite extraordinary.
That is extraordinary. Well, let's find out what all that's about then. Sarah Shaw's first job at the BBC was with the School Broadcasting Council, after which she went on to work on radio programmes for secondary schools. Later, she returned to the television plays department and worked on BAFTA-winning productions such as The Lost Boys. In the 1980s, she became an academic librarian, retiring in 2014 after 12 years, as we've heard, at Selwyn College, Cambridge. Portland Place is based on the diary she kept as a 19-year-old secretary at the BBC in the early 1970s and covers not just the professional manoeuvres within the Beeb, but also politics, feminism, family relationships and her own sexual awakening, courtesy of a very unlikely love interest. Jill Dawson described it as Sue Townsend meets Lynn Barber. It captures the genuine innocence girls had back then. And I think Jill's hit the nail on the head there. You can't read this book, Sarah, really, without fully understanding 1971. I think I was 7 years old at the time, I'll fess up. But perhaps you can just paint a picture of what life was like a little bit during 1971.
Well, I can do it from my own perspective as a young person, that where we were working, for example, was very much a situation where there were a lot of secretaries in the department, all of whom were women, and I think all of the bosses, bar two, were men. And there were a lot of assumptions there about what women were going to do and how they were going to work, that they would work for a few years, then they would stop and they would get married and they would have children. And of course, they wouldn't go out to work then. Well, certainly middle class women wouldn't. I suppose the other thing about the 70s that I remember most clearly is that it was a rather turbulent decade. There was a lot of industrial action and go slows and strikes. Life was a bit unpredictable. But at the same time, it was perhaps a more relaxed place in that there was less pressure on the individual to achieve and to succeed or exceed, to live up to your dreams and all that kind of stuff. You were kind of much more likely to be going along within a kind of parameter that was set for you by society, and nobody really expected you to do anything extraordinary. Having said which, of course, there were a lot of women who did go on and do very extraordinary things. But for the bulk of us, I think there was almost a comfort that we weren't expected to do something stunningly brilliant in our lives. And I do think there's quite a lot of pressure on people now to achieve as individuals without the kind of support and framework that we enjoyed at that time.
And obviously the diary is a lot about your personal life, but just to dwell on the professional for a moment, it does strike me as really interesting. You're working at the School Broadcasting Council on sex education programmes, and what was allowed and what wasn't, given what we see on TV today, even before The Watershed.
Oh, yes. I mean, that was very different. I mean, you can tell from reading the book, my sexual knowledge was very, very limited in a way that, you know, probably a 15-year-old now would look at it and think how ridiculous, because information is so much more readily available. And it was hugely controversial. The BBC was actually just begun making these programmes for primary school pupils. They had already been doing them for secondary school students. And there was absolute outrage. I mean, I was brought in to work in an office that was being sent letters every day, 20, 30, 40 letters from people complaining that the BBC should not be pushing out this information to young children, you know, that it was going to damage them. In fact, the programmes themselves were incredibly innocent, very sweet. It was all about kittens and eggs and mummy and daddy and all that sort of thing. And yet there were, you know, there were quite genuine, quite deeply felt objections to primary school children being exposed to this kind of information.
And within all this, as you mentioned, you have the burgeoning and the beginning of feminism, really. You mention in the diaries reading Germaine Greer, Female Unit, and it was certainly something you talked a lot about with your friends.
Yes, and it was quite a challenge. I mean, I'd been brought up in a fairly traditional 1950s family, and I couldn't really understand what feminists were on about. You know, I couldn't grasp it, but I could see there was something there. And by the end of the year, as you see if you read the diary, I'm beginning to put my own experiences within the light of a new way of thinking about life, myself, relationships, and so on. And it certainly helped to give me confidence in the way that I thought about my life and what I was going to do. But they, possibly one or two of the older friends of mine, women who were perhaps 2, 3, 4 years older than me and had a bit more experience of life, were very interested in what Greer in particular was writing and could relate it much more to their own lives. So it was a topic that we could discuss over lunch, you know, and I learnt a lot from that sort of thing.
Because I think it's fairly safe to say that you'd come from a fairly sheltered background.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah. Not just sheltered, I mean sort of wrapped up for various reasons, quite, you know, obvious reasons. But it was, you know, it was the sort of beginning of my not just my sexual awakening, if you like, but also a kind of intellectual interest. And within the time, by the time I'd left the BBC, say 3 or 4 years later, I certainly had a very different set of values and outlooks than I'd had before I started there.
So into this cauldron of politics and feminism, Wanders Frank, who is the subject of the book. I mean, there pretty are lots much, of, yeah. pretty much the subject of the book and your relationship with him. Mm. I said he was an unlikely love interest. He was, wasn't he? Tell us a little bit about Frank.
Frank was an amazing guy. He was one of the lift men in the building that I was working in, which was the Langham, which is now a very, very grand hotel, but a very tall, big building, and you needed lifts to get up and down. He was an Irishman. He was quite a bit older than me. He was married. He was very well liked by everybody. In fact, several people have written to me since the book was published saying that they remember him and remember what a sort of affable, friendly guy he was. So, yes, he was very popular. He was a very kind person. He had a very good sense of humour. And he used to sing a lot in the lift, which is something that doesn't actually come over in the book because he did it all the time and I never wrote down about it. But yeah, he was just a very, very charming in the way that Irish people often are, very friendly. And I guess he was just somebody who I clicked with for a short while, you know. And if you read this book, you'll see how this relationship develops and we kind of start off on slightly the wrong foot with each other and then it changes and then I go off him and then I decide I like him again, you know. And there's all this sort of coming and going in the relationship. And then by the end of the year, I think it's gone on to another level, you know.
He's a little older than you, I think.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. I didn't realise how old he was at the beginning. And obviously, as you read the book, it becomes clear what his situation is.
OK, we'll get up to... we'll find out what you got up to. That left us extraordinary. But we'll take an autistic digression for the time being. Emma Bennett is a collage artist living and working in Cambridge. As editor of the Cambridge Art Book, she was responsible for commissioning and coordinating a collection of images of the city as seen through the eyes of its many artists. When I met Emma, I started by asking her to describe the book for those who've not yet seen it.
Sure. So it's a hardback book, which is there's about 120 pages. I think about 117 of those are beautiful contemporary images. Amazingly, there's 51 artists represented in the book. There's a very beautiful map inside the front cover, which has been designed by a map artist called Jenny Seddon. And the idea is that it's with the inclusion of the map that people can look at the map and then take a lovely stroll around Cambridge to Ely and see how the artists in the book have interpreted various sites in and around Cambridge. So, yeah, hardbacked and just full of beautiful images.
It is a beautiful book.
Thank you. I can confirm
that. And where did the idea for the book come from?
So last July, my husband and I had a very rare few days away in Liverpool, where we spent a great deal of time at the Tate Modern, I have to say, drinking coffee and in the bookshop, because it was quite rainy. And I was just really loved the range of contemporary art books available in the bookshop there. We bought a really beautiful one of New York, which is a city we both love. And a few months later, I thought, oh, I was looking through the book and I thought there must be a Cambridge version of this, a really good contemporary art book to show the city. And I went to various art bookshops. And although there's some really beautiful art books about the city there, there was nothing that was sort of from a wide variety of artists. So I sort of had the idea and thought, well, somebody should have done this because Cambridge is an incredible resource for artists. I think the idea sort of was there in the background. And then a couple of months later, I was on a train going to London and I got my notebook out and I thought, oh, that idea I had, how crazy is that? And literally, you know, you just started making notes. And by the time I got to London, was quite buzzing. And I was actually meeting a friend there at the V&A who's an artist and said, I've got this idea. What do you think? And she said, crazy idea, but go with it. It sounds amazing. So one of those simple ideas that sort of was there. And yeah. So
and here we are.
Less than a year later. So it's happened very quickly. But it's been a lot of hard work, but such an amazing experience as well.
And as you say, quite interesting that there was no book like this around, because A, not only is Cambridge absolutely beautiful and inspiring,
absolutely.
But B, it's full of artists.
We've got incredible, I mean, through the galleries here, open studios. I mean, so many wonderful artists. And I think as an artist, it's hard sometimes to get your work out there to be recognised. I'm fortunate that I'm represented by Bayard Art, which is a gallery in Cambridge. We all know each other, a lot of us. We're all working very independently and very supportive of each other. But yes, an incredible city to be inspired by. And artists working in a huge range of different media as well, all ages, experiences. So, yes, we're so fortunate in this city. So it was almost a case of trying to bring everything together into one book that hopefully will just make people smile. That was always the intention for it.
And you do have a range of artists in the book as well, don't you? It's not just your classic view of King's College.
No, I think that's what's great about it, is that we've got 51 artists and a huge range of experience from people who are very well known and collected by the likes of Joanna Lumley and big London galleries, to people who go out on a Saturday morning with their sketchbook, to students from Anglia Ruskin. We've got all ages, different mediums. So I'm a collage artist, so hand-cut collage. We've got printers in there. We've got sketchers in there. We've got a textile artist there. I mean, a really broad range of media represented. So I think when I started out, I thought, well, if I could get about 20 artists involved, that would be an achievement. And in the end, we had over 50 submitting images for consideration.
And how did you decide which ones went in?
I always knew that that was going to be a nightmare of a job, because we all have different tastes, and that's great. Everybody has their own art that they love. So quite early on, I got together, I approached a panel of sort of top art and city experts, so people from the likes of Cambridge Magazine. There was an animator from Aardman, Professor Martin Salisbury from Anglia Ruskin. We had over 300 images submitted, and we all sat down in January and went through all of the images. None of the artist's name were on the images, so that it was all done very fairly. And yeah, it was a hard job because of the range that was there. So narrowing it down was actually the hard job. But I was very grateful to the panel to be there to help me, because I don't think I could have done that myself.
And I know there are pictures of King's College in, because why wouldn't there be? But there are also other little unexplored areas or undiscovered artistic areas.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to have the iconic buildings in there, like King's and St John's. But yes, we've also got a lovely part of the book is about Mill Road, which we're close to here, with which is all the independent shops on Mill Road. There's the Botanical Gardens, the Gogmagog Downs. Parker's Peace is a great picture of Jesus Green Lido. Lots on the river. And then it goes sort of through out of Cambridge, Wickham Fenway, and then out to Ely as well. So there's the familiar in there, but also the unfamiliar. I hope with the book that people will say, well, look at the map and just go and look at these sites for themselves and see how 10 artists might have interpreted the same building or the same site in a completely different way.
It's a very accessible book, and presumably that was part of what you wanted to do, was to say, you know, art isn't some great thing that other people do. Yeah. It's out there.
It really was. We quite early on, I was approached by a big London publisher who wanted to publish it as a very high-end, big, glossy art book that would sit on people's coffee table at a ridiculous price. And that was never the intention. For me, I'm a former teacher. I've got kids. I want everybody to see this book, not just visitors to Cambridge, but locals as well. So we kept it sort of guidebook size so that you can pick it up, put it in your bag. And I just hope people will go and explore and see the art. It will inspire people to see the sites, but also maybe have a go at art themselves, or, you know, just see what the range of different media there is out there.
Now, you mentioned Joanna Lumley earlier on, and she's one of the people quoted on the back, alongside some utterly fantastic names.
Yes.
You've got Dame Fiona Reynolds, David Attenborough, is that right?
No, not I did get a letter from David Attenborough saying how great it was, but no, we've got Stephen Fry, Claudia Winkleman, Dame Fiona Reynolds, who's Master of Emmanuel, Sir David King, Jackie Ashley, who's President of Lucy Cavendish, as well as Joanna Lumley. And for a week I was getting these really bizarre emails from people saying, you know, Stephen Fry saying, I'm going to look at the images this weekend and I'll get back to you, and Joanna Lumley, well, I'm filming out in India, but I'll have a look. And Claudia Winkleman, who studied art at Cambridge, saying, oh, I'm going to have my lunch, I'll sit down with it then. So, yeah, a really bizarre time. But it's great because they're all people that are familiar, well, all over, but particularly Cambridge people. So, yeah, it's great that they liked it and enough to give us an endorsement.
I didn't know that Claudia Winkleman studied
art.
Yeah,
she studied history of art at Newhall.
So from that coffee in the Tate
yes.
Gallery to emails with Stephen Fry to this beautiful book, it's been quite a journey for you.
It's been an incredible journey. It's kind of brought in lots of experiences I've had in previous jobs. As I say, I'm a commercial artist here. But I think for me, probably one of the favourite parts of the whole process, and it has been a challenge, was the sort of 2 months or so that I research the artists themselves. I'm fortunate, I know quite a few, and I've got some that I really admire their work. But for 2 months, I literally just trawled through people's work and approached people and said, oh, well, how about submitting images for this book, which was just an idea at the time. It really is thanks to the artists that they had a faith in it, the project, to submit images, and they all believed in it and wanted to be part of it, because without them it wouldn't have happened. So
what next for you, Emma, after a well-deserved rest? What next?
I think, yes, a well-deserved, yes, people keep saying to me, where's the next one going to be about? And I would like, I've got quite close ties to Oxford, so that could be done. But I think at the moment, just to enjoy this one, it's been really busy. And yeah, just to get people's reaction to this and just enjoy it, and hopefully, yeah, just get good feedback from it, hopefully.
And am I allowed to ask you, do you have a favourite image in the book?
I don't. I'm asked that, and I think it would be impossible because they are such an amazing range. I think the diversity in it, and also the quirky, I like. So there's a local urban sketcher who did a sketch of Adam Brooks with cranes, and for me that's just, you know, sums up Cambridge, the cranes. But no, it would be impossible because they are all, in their own way, just beautiful images, I think.
And they are indeed. And that's Emma Bennett, editor of the Cambridge Art Book there, which is published by UIT Books. You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105. Our studio guest is Sarah Shaw, talking about her diary, her memoir, really, Portland Place, based on her diaries that she kept as a 19-year-old secretary at the BBC in the early 1970s. Emma talking there about those quotes from famous people on the back of her book, the endorsements there. You must have rubbed shoulders with some famous people in your time, Sarah, at the BBC.
Yeah, but unfortunately, a lot of them aren't around anymore because we're going back quite a long time there. But yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, in this particular book, because I was quite a junior secretary, I should say that it's not a kind of celebrity memoir. It isn't like I sat down and had a cup of coffee with, I don't know, Terry Wogan or Eric Morecambe or something like that. Although they were people that you saw in the distance, you know. When I got to work in television towards the end of the 70s, that was a kind of little bit more celebrity focused. Famously, I once asked Angela Rippon the way to the canteen at Television Centre because I failed to recognise her. I thought I vaguely knew her, and it was only halfway into the conversation that I realised who she was.
Well, she should have known as a newsreader.
Well, that's it. I thought, I know her face from somewhere, you know. In the early days as well, the funny thing was, if you worked in radio, you would go into the BBC club where everybody went to pick up their tea and coffee or have a drink after work or something. And you would hear people, you would hear voices behind you, and you'd think, oh, that, I recognise the voice. Of course, you turn around and you don't recognise the face because there's somebody on radio. And they don't look remotely like what you imagine that they're ever going to look like. I was sort of, in the early 70s, I was recognising voices rather than faces.
Well, let's go to your second choice of music now, which is Pete Atkin, Touch Has a Memory. Why this one?
Because I think it, well, partly because Pete's a Cambridge guy and it's a wonderful song that he wrote with Clive James, whom they met in Cambridge, but also because it's so evocative of the strength of the sensory memory.
Better than the other senses, hearing and sight fight free, touching has no defences. Textures come back to you, real as can be. Touch has a memory. Fine eyes are...
Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations rather than boasts.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. Our studio guest today is Sarah Shaw, author of Portland Place, which is a selection of her diaries taken in 1971, isn't it? Really 1971
with a little bit
to 74.
After, yeah.
And we left listeners dangling, really, as to what you and Frank got up to in the lift. What didn't you get up to in the lift? But this isn't really a sordid story. It is very much a love story. And I'll read a quote to you that you say at the end of the book. We don't want to give anything away. But for me, the secret of the diary, you say, is that I found inside it the love that Frank left there for me.
Yeah.
It's very touching.
Well, that is because, obviously, when I sat down and wrote the diary, and I was living in a rather sort of old Victorian building. It was a hostel, girls' hostel. You know. And I didn't have much money. I didn't go out much in the evening. So it was kind of, what am I going to do? So I sat down and wrote this diary every evening. And of course, I was young. If you read it, you can see I have some rather sort of opinionated ideas about the world and about myself and all the rest of it, as young people do. And when I was editing the book for publication, I was sort of reading it again as a 19-year-old and thinking, oh, yes, I remember this. And this is kind of like where touch as a memory comes in, because I could, as I was doing it, I suddenly thought, oh, my gosh, I can remember exactly how that felt or what that looked like. All this stuff started coming back. Very, very vivid memories, that things I'd completely forgotten about. And it wasn't until I'd sort of got partway through that I started to think about the whole relationship from Frank's point of view. Who was Frank? You know, what was his background? What kind of life had he had? What kind of life was he living at the time? What was he hoping to get out of this relationship? And I suddenly saw something completely different that I had never realised at the time. And I discussed it with my husband, who was incredibly helpful to me when I was doing the book. And he said, oh, yes, you know, you can tell how much Frank loved you. And I suddenly realised that, you know, there was this whole other story on his side that had completely missed me at the time.
That's what you discovered by going back and looking at the book.
Yes, yeah.
How much of the diary is actual diary written at that contemporaneous, and how much did you add in subsequently?
I would say about 85 to 90% of it is actually what I wrote at the time. All that I did was I cut out some of the more repetitive stuff, which wasn't particularly interesting. I cut out people who only appeared once because and didn't have much impact on my life, because I didn't think that was fair to readers. They would get confused with, well, you know, what's this person doing here? Why haven't we heard any more from them? I elaborated very slightly. So two or three of the incidents that I could remember clearly, but which I didn't mention in much detail at the time, because I realised, you know, when I was editing it, actually that was quite a significant moment and I can remember it well. And I thought, to make it more vivid to the reader, I would just drop in some of these kind of memories that were coming back to me, because that helps to bring it to life. And that's pretty much it. Some of the entries in the actual diary were sort of in note form. So it was walk to work, had a cup of coffee, you know, typed three letters. So I just strung it together in a sentence and said I typed three letters after I'd had a cup of coffee, because obviously I'd got to work, you know.
That's what's nice about it, is you get the sense of the routine and the mundane of a working life. But at the heart of it, this girl thirsty for experience and knowledge.
Yes, yes.
And how you ever got any work done, I don't know. You were up and down that lift.
Well, I don't know. I mean, actually, there are things where he says, oh, well, you know, I was really busy today. I didn't have much time to see Frank or something like that. So,
because all these encounters, really, almost all of them, took place in the lift, because that was the only space you met. And he used to jam it, didn't he, between floors?
Yes. Well, he worked out at some point during the year that there was one place, because it was like a birdcage lift, you know, which is one of those ones with the kind of, expandable doors that was open. So anybody could look in. But there was one spot in the Langham between two floors down in the basement where there was a solid wall. And if he positioned it absolutely accurately, the people on the floor above couldn't look down and the people from the floor below couldn't look up and couldn't see what was going on. So that was the one place that he would pitch the lift. Somebody said to me, how do you know he hadn't done this with other girls? And I said, because it took him so long to work out where was the one place in the Langham where he could stick the lift.
He comes across as such a charming man, but a complex man as well, because he was married, wasn't he? Yeah. He had a wife at home who was very ill.
Yeah. And I just don't know. I have a lot of... I'm gunning for Frank. I think he was a really lovely, funny, nice guy. And that just the fact that so many other people liked him, I think my judgment wasn't just, you know, through rose-tinted glasses.
How do you feel about exposing your diaries and exposing yourself and other people in them? How did you protect yourself and other characters?
There are quite... Well, virtually all the people in the diary are under a pseudonym, apart from myself, Frank. Two friends of mine, with whom I'm still in touch, who said, yeah, that's fine, you can put us in as our names. And one or two people who slipped through by accident. As far as I don't mind, actually, because it happened so long ago. I think of the Sarah Shaw who wrote this diary, this 19-year-old girl, as being obviously me, but also not me. You know, it's somebody who I can sympathise with, if you like. But, you know, she's a very, very much younger version of myself, and I can distance myself from her too.
And what was the journey from you discovering them to publication?
Oh, well, that was quite funny. I dug it out of the loft when we were about to move house. And I was going to throw the diary away, actually. And then I started reading it and I got hooked. And I thought, my goodness, this is the most extraordinary story. And I felt completely compelled to type it into the computer, which I did. And then I thought, now what am I going to do? And I sent it to, in fact, there are three friends who appear in the book who I'm still in touch with. I sent it to them just for a bit of a laugh. One of them, Jill Bozovsky, now teaches English literature at Swansea. And she got in touch with me and she said, I think you should do something with this. Do you want to make it into a novel? And I thought, no, because that's awfully hard work. We were about to move house. So I thought, OK, well, I'll just type it up, you know, and self-publish it, which is what I did. And to cut a long story short, it found its way to a literary agent who took it to a publisher. And I mean, I never thought of this as being remotely commercial. I just thought a few of my friends would enjoy reading it. But to my huge surprise, it's attracted a lot of attention and support. And I've had some lovely messages in from people who worked in offices in the 70s and said, oh, this is so much like me. People who've had kind of unsuitable relationships in their early life and said, oh, this is like the guy I used to meet on the train, you know, all that kind of stuff. But not just that, people who've bought the book because their mum was a secretary in the 70s and I've enjoyed reading it because I now understand what she was talking about, that sort of thing.
And has it spurred you on to write more? You talked about, oh no, a novel is hard work indeed, but would you try one of those now?
Possibly not, but I am at the moment in the early stages of putting together another book about secretaries in the 1970s, which I'm hoping may come to something.
Oh, that's exciting. Well, let's hear from Samina, who has written a novel. Jane Mensah is a drama teacher at a Cambridge comprehensive school. She won an Escalator Literature Award and a grant for the arts to help fund the completion of her debut novel, An Unlikely Agent. Set in 1905, it's a fast-moving spy tale in which the heroine, Margaret Trant, an avid reader of detective fiction, finds herself embroiled in a plot stranger than any she's encountered in her bedtime reading. So I asked Jane when we met if she too was a fan of detective fiction.
I have been at different times in my life. I think I'm just a voracious reader of all sorts of fiction, and I like very much like classic detective fiction, Dorothy L. Sayers, a bit of Agatha Christie, that kind of thing. Actually, predominantly I tend to read sort of literary fiction, but from a wide variety of different periods, so some very contemporary stuff, but I also enjoy reading stuff that was written in the Edwardian and Victorian periods as well.
And the period is very important, isn't it? Not just in terms of the plot, but the setting, the whole tone of the book.
The period is crucial. And actually, funnily enough, when I first started writing it, I wasn't quite sure when to set it. I was toying with the idea of setting it in the 1930s, in that kind of golden detective era. But as soon as I settled on the 1900, 1905, the whole thing came into focus, and it was such an interesting period to write about.
It's an interesting time because it's on the cusp of so many changes. Obviously, it's pre-World War One, and all the changes that came through that and subsequently.
Yes, absolutely. So you've got things like horse-drawn transport coexisting with cars, just before kind of aeroplanes, the suffragette movement. So there are all those kind of things we think of as being very modern, but then there are some things which still seem like they're from a really distant time. The structure of society still was much more kind of rigid than it is nowadays in terms of the class system, the role of women. I mean, the fact that Miss Trant goes out to work, I think, would have been quite unusual for that time, although there was that kind of army of women who were doing that.
For a reader, what is really nice about it, and I wonder if it's actually quite challenging for a writer, is that because it's set during that time, obviously we have no mobile phones, there's no modern technology, all those things that we use forensically now to place people or as plot devices, you don't have access to. It's letters.
Yes, but I quite like that. I feel like I would be more at home in that era, actually. I'm not very good. I mean, I write on a computer and I'm not completely technophobic, but I don't do social media and I don't have a smartphone, and I'm, you know, so I would actually feel slightly more at sea writing about now, actually, because I sort of feel like I wasn't up enough on the technology to be able to make it convincing.
And in terms of your plot, I suppose it allows you all kinds of subterfuge and confusion. It's not slower, but you can draw out the tension a little bit.
Yeah, there's more of a sense of a mystery there, perhaps, and this idea of secrets as well. I think, you know, it's easier for a secret to lie buried when people aren't constantly in communication with each other, and that somehow creates a kind of a distance. And then also that it's not easy to find things, so easy to find things out. Nowadays you can kind of just look things up at the touch of a button, but facts buried deep in the past are going to be much harder to uncover.
It feels very authentic, and one of the things that makes it authentic is the tone of the narrator, the tone of the book, really. It has got a register, an old-fashioned but pleasingly old-fashioned register to it. How did you find that?
Just through reading lots and lots of fiction that was written in the period or slightly earlier. So I went through a phase where really all I read was kind of Victorian and Edwardian literature. I just got that kind of voice in my head. After I've written things, I tend to read it out loud, which I think helps as well. Then you get the rhythm of it and the tone of it. Once I started going with the voice, it just seemed to come quite naturally.
And what did you find reading those books? What identified the tone of a voice, a narration in the past compared to the present?
I think there's a certain formality about it, which I quite like. I mean, it's a really big generalisation. I suppose you get quite sort of complex sentences with lots of clauses in them, slightly different vocabulary as well. It's getting a balance between making something that's readable for a modern reader, but which still sounds authentic in terms of the period. So I was very careful about things like individual phrases and words and making sure that I didn't use words and phrases that wouldn't have been used at the time. And I looked it up in the OED and made sure that there were a few that I had to actually get rid of. It's a combination of getting the pace and right so that it's readable, but at the same time getting that sense of authenticity.
And were you always going to write in that register? Because you didn't have to. It's a choice, isn't it? You could have written as a modern narrator, just setting the story in the past, and the dialogue could have had that feel to it, but not necessarily the words around.
I started it actually with the image which is at the opening of the book, which is of McIntyre walking across the misty beach. That bit sort of came in that register, and then, I mean, I almost wrote it initially, and certainly the first few chapters just came to me in the order that they are, and then I just kind of weirdly sort of almost heard Miss Trant's voice, and I think it always was going to be in that voice. It never occurred to me to write it in the third person or in a modern voice.
And you mentioned Miss Trant there, Margaret Trant. Where did she come from?
That's a really good question, and I don't know if I could pin down exactly where she came from. I think she's probably an amalgamation of all sorts of heroines from different novels that I've read. She just kind of developed as I was writing, really.
She goes through a real awakening as a character. The character at the end is quite different to the Margaret Trant at the beginning. Is that something you identified with? I'm asking you that because I'm very aware that you have spent time with Germaine Greer, who I'm sure can awaken any female soul.
I think I was very conscious of wanting to have a strong female protagonist for the novel, and I wanted her to kind of escape from that downtrodden, fairly miserable situation that she's in at the beginning. I had written a novel before this one where actually with a male narrator, and one of the things about that I wasn't so keen on was the fact that I didn't think the female characters were so strong. So this time I was very much wanting to write it from a female perspective and to show that kind of journey into being more independent and stronger.
So this is your debut novel. How does it feel to have it out there in the world?
It's amazing. It's taken me a long time to get to this point. So to actually kind of see it there in the bookshops, it's incredible, really.
And you were an escalatee, weren't you? You were part of the escalator mentoring course. Would you have been able to write this without that?
I don't think I would have got to this point with it without the escalator scheme. It was really, really important, you know, for lots of different reasons, partly the mentoring. I had lots of very useful advice from my mentor, Midge Gillis. But also, I think it gave me confidence just to have that kind of sort of acknowledgement that what I was doing was worthwhile. And because along with it, there was an Arts Council grant. Because I'm a teacher, it meant for two terms. At that point, I was working 5 days a week, so it meant for two terms I had a day a week to write. And also it allowed me to go on a research trip to Devon, where the second bit of the novel is set.
Well, you talk about research then, and by setting it in the Edwardian era, there was quite a lot of research, I imagine, around almost every element of life.
Absolutely. And that's something I really enjoyed doing. I tended to do it as I went along rather than kind of doing it all before I started. So as I found I needed to know about something, I went out and found out about it. I got a lot of the information from the books in the university library. So finding out all about the early days of the Secret Service, about day-to-day life in Edwardian London, because they've got all kinds of publications there. So I found, for example, a publication called The Era, which was really about music halls, but it also had all kinds of advertisements for kind of everyday products in it, which was also really useful.
And there was a Secret Service, was there, in Edwardian time?
It was in its very early days. There were sort of different government departments that were involved in different kinds of surveillance. The sort of prototype of MI5 began in 1909. That was because people were starting to get very paranoid about Germany and German spies. And although actually it was mostly paranoia that had been whipped up by the Daily Mail and various writers at the time and turned out to actually not have much basis at all, in fact. So, yes, yeah, so I think that kind of sketchiness actually appealed to me because they were very badly funded. There were hardly any people. So it kind of gave me the scope to invent, really.
You mentioned the Daily Mail whipping up public opinion there. Were there other similarities that you found between that time and the present?
There's the terrorism aspect. That wasn't something that I was really very conscious of when I was writing, but I suppose actually what I'd done is I'd looked back at the 1880s when there was kind of a spate of dynamite outrages and sort of thought about what would happen if that was to then recur in the early 20th century. And I suppose it's the idea that these things do recur and they come back. I suppose also, again, this is kind of after I'd written it, but the whole sort of post-Brexit feeling of that kind of nasty resentment against people, you know, immigrants, people coming in. I think that's reflected in some of the characters in the book as well. So I think there are definitely some parallels there.
And what's next for you then?
I'm currently finishing off a novel which actually I'd already finished, but which needed a lot of work and revision to it. So I'm hoping to get that done in the next few months. And then I'd like to write a sequel to An Unlikely Agent.
And Jane Mentzer's novel An Unlikely Agent is published by Polygon. Talking to Jane there, Sarah Shaw, about secrets and keeping secrets. How secret was your relationship with Fred? Because reading the book, I'm not sure it was as secret as you thought it was it?
Well, that's the funny thing. I mean, there obviously was some sort of office gossip going on because people kind of ask me slightly sideways on questions. My friend Jill Bozovsky, who was working just up the corridor from me, did know about it because I used to talk to her about it. But another close friend, Valerie, who I met again last year for the first time in some years, said was really quite surprised when she read the book, because she said, I've known you for all these years and I never knew that you had this relationship with Frank, not even when, you know, we were working together in the same building. So because it was so unlikely, people thought that we were just friends. They couldn't imagine that it was anything more than that.
Even though the lift was out of action for at various points during
the
day.
Yeah, but they were old lifts, and both the lift, you know, they're actually very much controlled by the guys who are driving them, and occasionally they went wrong, and they would, if you took them above a certain height, they would go out of action altogether. So it wasn't entirely surprising that one of the lifts wasn't working, you know, or wasn't responding.
True. And I'm just wondering, read you another quote from your book. You say, this story demanded to be set free. So do you feel liberated now it's free?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's like it was a whole part of my life that I had boxed up and put away. And certainly in sort of immediately in the aftermath, and when I was bringing up my own family, if I ever thought about it, which was not very often, I was kind of, oh my goodness, did I really do that? And how awful. And yet when I found the diary and started reading, it was a completely different perspective. And I thought, actually, this is quite sweet. It wasn't awful at all. You know, there's nothing that I should feel ashamed about or embarrassed about. And, you know, sort of in you know, working through the diary and having the book published and reading the reaction to it, I certainly feel quite differently about it. I feel very comfortable with it now.
Had you felt ashamed? I can understand, given the time it happened, you were an unmarried woman, he was a married man, the age difference, the secrecy, the massive differences between
them. I think when you're young, you see people aren't very understanding. And I didn't want my friends, the friends that I made subsequently to sort of being in that job, I thought it would be awful. I could imagine the blokes, saying, oh, my goodness, she was doing this, and so on and so forth. And I just sort of, I think I just keep quiet about this. I don't think I want people to know, that would have involved quite a lot of explanation that I really didn't want to go into. I was looking for a suitable partner, of my own age, really, which I eventually found. But, it was a sort of like an uncomfortable part of my life. Because I saw it as a sort of 20-year-old who'd moved out of that relationship.
And yet it was a year that changed your life.
Sorry?
It was a year that changed your life.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was a year that I grew up in, really. Yeah.
And you then went on to work some time later in Cambridge Colleges. Mm. Just wondering, are there any similarities between Cambridge Colleges and a 1970s BBC?
Well, actually, there were, because it was really funny. When I started working in Cambridge at the university, I thought, my goodness, this is just like the BBC. You've got your creatives, the academics, who don't like being tied down by, annoying things like budgets and stuff like that. They want to be able to go off and do their stuff and explore their own sort of worlds, which was very much like the way that production people worked within the BBC. And then you've got the huge raft of support services, all the administrative stuff, the librarians. And I mean, when I was working for the BBC in the 70s, there were no end of sort of departments of news cuttings and engineering and, personnel and all sorts of departments. And that was very similar with the university. And I think the university's actually kind of moved on quite a bit within the last 15, 20 years. But the resemblances were quite striking when I started there.
Well, it's been lovely talking to you today, Sarah. Portland Place by Sarah Shaw is published by Constable. One question that we ask all our guests, sorry to spring it on to you, I meant to prepare you for this, is what are you reading at the moment?
What am I reading at the moment?
Do you want to have a think and I'll come back to you?
Come back to me.
Because that does seem to be the question that most throws guests because they suddenly have to...
No, I'll tell you.
Oh, you remembered.
I'm actually rereading my most favourite book of all time, which is Norman Collins's London Belongs to Me, which people don't know about this, but it seems to be not that well known. And I think it is just the most brilliant book ever.
And what is that about?
It's a novel set in immediately pre-Second World War London, and it's about the people living in a house in sort of Kennington area and all the different things that happen to them. But it's almost like modern Dickens. The characterisations and the stories and the humour in it are just brilliant.
Lovely, thank you. As I say, Portland Place, published by Constable. And our next show, the studio guest is Hina Bellet. She's talking about her novel Set Me Free. We'll also hear from Joanne Lindbergh on her memoir, Small Pieces, A Book of Lamentations, her account of coming to terms with her brother's suicide and through that process, her own family life and her Jewishness. And we'll be talking to Diana Gerald, Chief Executive of the Book Trust, and children's author Nadia Shireen on the Time to Read campaign, which champions reading with children. We'll also hear from Kate Fleet of Heffer's Bookshop about forthcoming events there. And speaking of forthcoming events at Heffer's, before then, on September the 28th, you can join Ben Aronovich, best-selling author of the Rivers of London series, for the launch of his latest novel in that series, The Furthest Station. Or on the 10th of October, Emily Winslow is having the launch for her new novel, Look for Her. We featured Emily on the programme before, and that is open to anyone. If you want to find out more about those two events and how to join up and sign up, go to heffers.co.uk. Also, while I'm signposting you where to go, why not go to our Facebook page, the Bookmark Facebook page, sign up and like us there. They'll also, on that page, be the chance to win a signed copy of Portland Place and all the podcasts of all the bookmarks from the beginning of time are on our website cambridge105.co.uk, which is also home to the podcasts of all our many other brilliant shows on the station about cinema, about food, so that is well worth a visit. But we're going to sign out now with your last choice of music, Sarah. This is, let me pronounce it properly, Dona Nobis Pacem.
Parchem.
Parchem by Bach from the Mass in B minor. Why this one?
I was lucky enough to sing in several amateur choirs when I was working in Cambridge, and I love the B minor Mass. It's a heck of a sing, and you stagger through to the end and you're just about to collapse, and you've got this gorgeous chorus of people asking for peace, and I think that's just kind of the most important thing, isn't it, really?